Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the biggest stories of the 2020 election was the story of Georgia. Long a Republican stronghold, by a narrow margin, Georgia flipped to the Democratic Party in 2020 in the race for president and then became a center point for Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election results, and of course in two Senate seats that ensured Democratic control of the Senate. 2022 will be an equally important battleground as Stacey Abrams, who led the efforts to turn out new votes in the state, and incumbent Governor Brian Kemp are expected to have a rematch of their very close 2018 race. And Senator Raphael Warnock will have to run for a full term in the seat that he won in 2020. The story of how Georgia flipped in 2020, though, is not a singular story, but a much longer story that goes back about a decade. And my guest today has covered that longer story, which he recounts in full in his new book, Flipped, How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Monopoly on Republican Power. Greg Bluestein is a political reporter who covers the Georgia governor's office and politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He contributes to the Political Insider blog, hosts the Politically Georgia podcast, and is a contributor to NBC News and MSNBC. He writes a fascinating account of all the stories that took place in 2020, 2018, and the lead-up to those important elections in Georgia. Greg Bluestein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, Flipped, accounts how Georgia turned purple in the 2020 election, and it is a longer story than just that election cycle. But if you were to be told that after the 2020 election, as you began that election cycle, that you would have two Democratic senators and Democrats would carry Georgia in the presidential election, What would have been your reaction?
I would probably have given it maybe a 15% chance at best, you know, and it took a lot of different things, a lot of different factors to make this happen. But certainly it was no fluke. It was no overnight miracle. I mean, it took groundwork for Democrats. And also it took galvanizing energy around the pandemic, around the protests for social justice. And of course, it took infighting about Trump. All those factors kind of came together to make Georgia the premier battleground state in the nation.
What was the first step in that building that foundation in your view?
I mean, to me, it goes back to 2010, to when Stacey Abrams was elected to the Georgia legislature and said, you know what, we can work with majority Republicans. Republicans control the state house in Georgia, but we can also be more authentically liberal and progressive to engage a base of voters that was being kind of neglected, was being overlooked by a lot of Democrats. For a long time in Georgia, Democrats ran as Republican lights, right? They ran as NRA Democrats. They ran basically touting a lot of the same issues that Republicans touted, just with a sort of different approach and a few different policy perspectives. But Stacey Abrams kind of upended that dynamic in 2018 when she ran a campaign that opened with expanding voting rights access. It talked about criminal justice reform and decriminalizing marijuana, gun control, and a lot of these issues that are standard fare in a lot of Democratic politics in Georgia and elsewhere now, but were simply not that long ago.
And you begin really the story of the electoral story with the story of John Ossoff's challenge for a congressional seat in a special election in 2017. Ossoff really came out of nowhere during that election and came pretty darn close to winning that congressional seat at one point.
Yeah, I thought that was a great place to start because you have John Ossoff. You're right. He came from out of nowhere. He was an unknown candidate in Georgia. He called me in January of 2017 to say that he was going to run for this special election to represent a Republican-leaning suburban district just north of Atlanta. And I thought he was crazy. I'll be honest. I was like, who is this guy? He's younger than I was. I never heard of him in my life. And he calls me up and says, well, I have the endorsements of Hank Johnson and John Lewis, and I also have about $250,000 in cash commitments. And I said, okay, you're legit. But still, that was a district that Republicans had held by 21 points just a few months earlier. And he was going to wage a campaign to flip it. And as you mentioned, he came really close. He came within about 2 points of winning this election. And that was based on a pretty moderate platform. He didn't mention Donald Trump's name. He didn't go head to head with Donald Trump near the, at least not close to the election. He wouldn't say whether he'd back Nancy Pelosi as the House Speaker. And then after his defeat, he kind of recalibrated, said, you know, that wasn't the real John Ossoff. He wanted to be his more authentic progressive core. And he felt like Stacey Abrams had maybe helped pave that path by showing that, hey, Democrats running on a liberal platform can actually come pretty close to winning Georgia. And so he went out and tested his message in rural areas in Georgia where there was only a handful of Democrats. And the message started sinking in, you know, talking about forgiving student debt and overhauling federal criminal justice rules and, you know, expanding access to healthcare and abortion and all these issues that Democrats, again, used to steer clear from. And this time in the 2020 election, it resonated with a significant number of voters enough to flip that seat.
Can you talk about that process of Democrats actually speaking to more of their national party aspirations as opposed to this sort of local feeling that you had to pick up moderate Republicans and independents to have any chance of election?
Yeah, and that was the formula for success. The recipe that Democrats had for a long time in Georgia was you couldn't win without getting 30% of the white vote. You couldn't win if you didn't boost, you know, that number of moderate white voters who used to be Democrats and had flipped to the Republican Party over the last few decades. And it takes a lot of effort to win those voters back, right? And multiple Democratic campaigns, Jason Carter in 2014 when he ran for governor, Michelle Nunn in 2014 when she ran for U.S. Senate, their campaigns were based upon winning back those moderate voters. And they just didn't budge, really. And so in 2018, Democrats said, hey, we might still win. We still want those moderate voters. And we'll still win some of them because they feel neglected by Donald Trump and they're upset with Trump-era politics. But where we know we really can pick up ground is by reaching those voters who are already liberal, who are already on our side, who just aren't voting. And that takes enormous resources and effort as well, because there are so many voters in every state who kind of sit on the sidelines, especially when there's not a presidential election, especially for midterm elections. And Democrats set out in Georgia to win over those voters, to mobilize, energize, engage them in a way that they hadn't been engaged before. And it paid tremendous dividends for them.
Talk a little bit about that re-engagement effort. A lot of credit nationally is given to Stacey Abrams. But can you talk about the grassroots efforts to get people who hadn't been a part of the electoral process to return to it and to look at Democratic tickets as a possible way of voting? You know, this is also given the fact that Brian Kemp, as Secretary of State and as governor, was busy pulling voters who hadn't voted off the voting rolls.
Yeah, to say this work is painstaking, arduous, is an understatement, because these are, you know, we always talk about the high-level effects of this, right? The Stacey Abrams of the world who led these efforts, but it really took the action on the ground for these volunteers who would go door to door, you know, long before elections, and try to inform voters about the issues that are going to become, you know, forefront in Georgia. And I was with some of these activists in 2017 when they'd go door to door and talk about, you know, let's say Stacey Abrams running for governor, and no one knew who Stacey Abrams was in Georgia. And outside of her like metro, her inside in-town Atlanta area, like very few people knew who she was. And she had this ground game where she tried to mobilize these voters very, very early and engage them on issues like expanding Medicaid, like new gun control restrictions, issues that were near and dear to them that, whether it be her polls or just be talking to voters, resonated. And, you know, a lot of campaigns in Georgia were based on TV ads and digital ads and all that. And she made an early decision to focus on the building up a grassroots network. And again, that sort of work pays off. In the 2020 cycle, we saw that on a grander scale. You know, John Ossoff's campaign hired thousands of voters. They had the money to do it because there was a flood of money coming in Georgia. But they hired thousands of voters to reach out to their networks, their friends and their families, and tell them to vote for John Ossoff, and here's why. And they had ready-made messaging to knock on doors and to spread the word about this Democratic candidates. Of course, Republicans were doing this too, but Democrats were able to effectively turn out their base all over again for these runoffs that flipped control of the Senate, while Republicans were still engrossed in all this Trump fighting.
Yeah, this is the other part of the story. Is one part of the story I found very interesting was the fact that, yes, we know all about the divisions within the Republican Party over Trump, anti-Trump, or just not taking to the excesses of some of Trump's rhetoric and others embracing it. But on the Democratic side, there were also divisions there that sort of were I guess in a way, steamrolled by Stacey Abrams. You talk about the battle between the two Staceys for the Democratic nomination in 2018. And this was the old Democratic way of going out to appeal to moderates and independents and white voters disaffected by both parties versus a progressive scheme. Can you talk about that conflict within the Democratic Party? And has that sort of been resolved at this particular point?
Yeah, and that was the big debate in 2018 because, again, Stacey Abrams was not the household name in politics that she is now. She was still the favorite in that race, but she was a lesser-known candidate, and there was a lot of questions about whether she could raise the money, whether or not she could be an effective coalition builder in Democratic politics in Georgia. And she was going up against Stacey Evans, a wealthy attorney from the suburbs of Atlanta who's white, who had a different approach. She had the more conventional approach. She relied on a lot of the old establishment figures in Georgia Democratic politics. The former governor, Roy Barnes, was one of her key endorsers. She also had a lot of African-American support, too. So she had a broad-based coalition as well. But her message was, hey, we cannot win Georgia without winning over suburban voters who used to be Republicans. And Stacey's message was, yeah, we can also win them, but we can't win without, by just relying on the African-American vote, by taking it for granted. And her Stacey Abrams' message ended up winning in a landslide. And so now that debate in Georgia has effectively been put to the side. Now it's Stacey Abrams' strategy. And 2022 will be a giant litmus test, a major litmus test for whether or not Stacey Abrams' approach in 2018 and in 2020 will work in 2022. And I want to say in the post-Trump era, but it's not the post-Trump era, because Donald Trump is still influencing everything that's happening in Georgia. And he came to a campaign event over the past weekend in Georgia to stump for 7 of the candidates that he's endorsed.
And again, so those divisions in the Republican Party are still there because he's endorsed people other than the incumbent governor. He certainly endorsed somebody other than the incumbent Secretary of State, mm-hmm. Brad Raffensperger, as well as a host of other candidates. So are those divisions greater than 2020 or lesser in your view in the Republican Party?
I think they're just a continuation of 2020, although he is now openly in open warfare with the Republicans in a way that he wasn't in the aftermath of the November vote, right? Everyone kind of played nicely up until November 2020. And then after, you saw this escalation that continually intensified, and it resulted in, to me, like the kind of the major point was when Trump called on Brian Kemp to resign. That was like, okay, you're not going back after that. And now he's backing candidates to oust him, vowing that he'll be defeated. Donald Trump even said once that he'd rather see Stacey Abrams as governor than Brian Kemp, which was sort of unthinkable for a lot of Republicans to hear. And there's major questions about how important his endorsement, whether his endorsement still has the same heft and weight that it used to in Georgia, because it used to be the sort of golden ticket, as our lieutenant governor likes to say. But we're not sure whether or not it still is this powerful tool that it used to be. But certainly we're seeing candidates up and down the Republican ticket who are either completely basing their campaign on his support or at least trying to cozy up to Donald Trump, even if they don't have his endorsement.
Really, this whole schism that exists today is attributable to one event, and that is those government officials, Brian Kemp, Brad Raffensperger, upholding the results, a lawful results of an election. Because Brian Kemp was, I don't know how Trumpy he was, but he was he was gun rights. He was out there on all the social issues. He was in the Trump model when he ran for governor in 2018.
Yeah. You're exactly right. He ran as a Georgia First candidate. That's how he announced his campaign in 2017. And of course, he won Donald Trump's endorsement in 2018. It was this shocking, shocking move in Georgia. No one, including the Kemp campaign, saw this coming when Donald Trump endorsed Brian Kemp 6 days before a runoff election against a more well-known candidate. And it fueled his runaway victory. I mean, he trounced his Republican rival by 40 or 50 points. It wasn't even close. Because of Donald Trump's support. And then to see this break between the two men, it didn't, it started earlier than that. Donald Trump was upset about how Brian Kemp treated the coronavirus, handled the economy during the coronavirus, and he was upset that Brian Kemp picked Kelly Loeffler to be his U.S. Senate appointee. But it really intensified after the November election when Donald Trump and his allies wanted Brian Kemp to call a special legislative session that would have pushed legislation that seeking to overturn the election. We're not sure exactly what legislation would have come up, but it would have probed, investigated. It would have led to voting changes that would have caused all sorts of legal battles, and that frankly would have brought concerns of violence at the Georgia State House, because there was protesters, there was counter-protesters. It was already a very fraught environment. And imagine putting lawmakers who were pushing to overturn the election or rewrite election rules midstream in the middle of all that. And of course, there's Brad Raffensperger, who directly defied Donald Trump's demand to find enough votes to overturn his election defeat. So you had two Republican officials who basically said to Donald Trump, no, you know, and for that, they are still paying the price.
Well, one of the things I wanted to know about Georgia, because as anybody who watched the aftermath of the 2020 election and the presidential election, we got to know these counties surrounding Fulton County in Atlanta, mm-hmm. you know, Gwinnett County, Cobb County. 10 years ago, this was very solid Republican territory. What has happened to those suburbs demographically in, say, the last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, and that's been one of the most fascinating parts of Georgia politics. The story of the suburbs, where I live, frankly. I live in those northern suburbs around the northern arc of Atlanta. And when growing up, Cobb County, Gwinnett County, they were the cornerstones of Republican politics. Even when Democrats were in charge of Georgia, because Democrats ruled Georgia for generations before the early 2000s, and it was those counties where Republicans had their major foothold. That's where Newt Gingrich got his start, Tom Price, Johnny Isaacson. Some of the, you know, the more towering figures in Republican politics in the South, their bases of support were not in rural Georgia, but they were in the suburbs. And a couple of things happened. One is the suburbs, you know, are no longer stereotypical lily white suburbs in Atlanta. They're very diverse. Gwinnett County is one of the most diverse counties east of the Mississippi. And it's not just black, white diverse. It's Asian American. It's Hispanic. There's a tremendous Vietnamese and South Korean population in Gwinnett County, for instance. An Indian American population. And so they've helped drive a much more diverse electorate, but also one that's more open to voting for Democrats. And then also the Trump era happened, right? And so a lot of those Republican moderate voters that we've been talking about felt disaffected by Trump, felt disgusted by him, and either voted against him or in some cases voted against his allies. And so that helped Democrats as well. So now, you know, you go from Cobb County and Gwinnett County being these hallmarks of Republican, these fortresses for the GOP, to now they are the center of the Democratic coalition. You know, Gwinnett County has only grown bluer. Cobb County is now home to a legion of Democratic local officials as well. And Gwinnett County is completely run by Democratic county commissioners. And so that's been an important part of the story. And it's also forced Republicans to go further afield to find their voters, right? Gwinnett County is not flipping back red anytime soon. So Republicans are forced to go find red counties and find even more voters in those red counties, trying to make already bright red counties redder.
How much of also that changing demographics and maybe the changing feelings is due to the, you know, Atlanta is a business powerhouse in this country, and it has really diversified the population through the business attraction of businesses. Has that had an effect as well?
Yeah, it has. I mean, Atlanta is a corporate town. Multiple Fortune 500 companies from Coke, Delta, Home Depot are all based at UPS, all based in Metro Atlanta. And the corporate community has a very, very strong say, a strong hand on what legislation gets passed, what policies are pushed. And frankly, you know, the CEOs of those worlds have always had very close relations with party leaders from both sides of the aisle. But we've started to see that sort of shake in the last few years in Georgia. Republican lawmakers passed a religious liberty bill in 2016 over the objections of the corporate powers. It was vetoed by the governor at the time, Nathan Deal, but it was seen as like a big, you know, as a schism that has only widened. And in this past election year, in last year, after the 2020 election, Republican lawmakers responded to the falsehoods about election fraud by passing a rewrite of election measures that many of Georgia's corporate powers disagreed with. And they made it very clear they disagreed with it. And that's led to some backlash as well. So we're seeing the corporate powers in Georgia kind of being branded as establishment Republicans, you know, kind of the rhinos of the world, the country club crowd. And you're seeing more of a, like you're seeing around the rest of the country, conservative voters being drawn to the outsiders.
My guest today is Greg Bluestein, a senior political writer for a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His book is titled Flipped, How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Monopoly on Republican Power. He reports on elections going back to about 2010, but really in key 2017 special election where John Ossoff was a congressional candidate, 2018 when Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp vied for the gubernatorial seat, and then 2020 when actually Georgia did flip. Was there anything different that happened in 2020 from 2018 as far as helping that flip occur?
Yeah, I mean, part of it was the ongoing falsehoods about election fraud. There were voters I talked to, because I'd go to these events for this book, and I went to a Stop the Steal event and interviewed dozens of voters afterwards. And there's voters who were genuinely frustrated. They wanted to go vote for the Republican candidates. They wanted to go vote for Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, but they had been fed so much misinformation about tainted ballot, you know, fraudulent mail-in ballots and Dominion voting machines and whatever it was, you know, whatever the conspiracy theory of the day was. And there, and I felt for these folks because they wanted to vote and they weren't going to listen to whatever I said because they were reading a steady diet of misinformation about how Donald Trump secretly won the election and you know, all this other stuff. And it got to the point on the Republican side where Kelly Loeffler's campaign even had a voter file full of tens of thousands of solidly Republican names that they couldn't even try to touch. And they called the voting file GOP not voting because these were Republicans who, no matter what you told them, thought that the election was rigged. And so it shows how all that, all those false narratives, all that sort of conspiracy theory ended up hurting the Republicans in the end. Democrats, meanwhile, were able to continue messaging on their behalf and accelerating Stacey Abrams' strategy of appealing to voters who felt like they were on the sidelines, who felt like they've been overlooked and neglected in the past. And John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock appealed to them very aggressively and ended up getting a record number of runoff voters to come to their behalf.
Yeah. Even given that, all three elections, the presidential election and the two Senate seats, were really close.
Very close.
Does that portend that Georgia has turned purple? Or is it a matter of, in this particular election, a combination of factors allowed those Democrats to win? Or do you really see a shift coming? And there's a lot of states in that situation where people mm-hmm. see the shift coming, but this is really the first state that has been solidly Republican for at least a generation that has seen that shift happen in one election cycle.
Yeah.
I guess this will be what 2022 is about, because Raphael Warnock is going to have to be on the ballot again. And of course, you have the governor's race with probably Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp.
Yeah, I think Georgia is not only is the premier battleground state, it might be the biggest test of Donald Trump's influence in the nation, because he's endorsed so many candidates up against strong incumbents, right? Like Governor Kemp, like Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. It's hard to predict anything in politics, but I think this is pretty broad enough to say it authoritatively. But I think Georgia is going to be a seesaw state. I think that Georgia is going to have, we're in for years of very close elections. We've seen Republican leads in Georgia dwindle from 10 points to 8 points to 5 points to 1.5 points to then being flipped in the last few election cycles. And I certainly don't see Georgia going solidly blue, you know, like other states that have flipped and then gone to, you know, 8-point Democratic leads. I think Georgia is just in for a long period of very tight elections. Because as you mentioned, Joe Biden won the state by about 11,000 votes. The two Democratic senators won by a few, you know, tens of thousands of votes, not hundreds of thousands of votes. It was very close, just a few points. And, you know, in elections like this one, a few points, you know, could swing very easily the other way. So who knows what will happen in November. But I can predict pretty affirmatively that it's going to be very, very close.
And as the 2022 cycle continues, you also have new restrictive voting laws. You know, and I think the provision that has gotten more attention than most that makes it a crime to hand out water for people standing in line. And I don't know how Georgia's elections work, but in a lot of states, you know, certain parts of the state, there will be incredibly long lines. Other places in the state, you can walk right in. And generally that also reflects the party that's in power somewhat. On the state level, what impact do you think these new voting laws are likely to have on turnout?
It is, by the way, it's heartbreaking to see these long lines. You know, as a reporter, of course, I go out and interview voters. And on primary day, on our day of our primary in 2020, I was in talking to voters in a precinct where not only was there an hours long line, but it just wasn't moving. And it wasn't because of some state, you know, conspiracy. It was, frankly, the local elections officials had sorts of malfunctioning problems with the new voter system, and they weren't equipped to fix them. And so voters paid the price. And yet, even amid all that, I talked to voters who brought lawn chairs and coolers and said, we are going to stay as long as it takes so we can vote. Of course, not every voter can do that. Not every voter can spend 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours like some of these people did to vote. But it is heartbreaking, and it's a sign of troubles in our election system when voters have to bring lawn chairs and coolers in order to cast their ballot. I think that, you know, a lot of attention has gone to that provision of the law. It says you can't hand out, that outside groups can't hand out food and water to people in those long lines. But I think the more serious issues that we'll be watching very closely here in Georgia are the other provisions of the law and how they affect the actual voting, because there are provisions that require photo IDs for mail-in ballots, that have tighter deadlines in which voters can turn in their mail-in ballots, that restrict or limit the use of ballot drop boxes for the first time in Georgia. And maybe perhaps the biggest one, and we don't even know how this will play out, is giving the Republican-controlled legislature the power to intervene in local elections matters if there's an investigation that shows the local elections officials have goofed up. And that is a very big concern, you know, if the Republican legislature takes over, let's say, a major Democratic county's election system right around the time of election, because those local elections boards make a tremendous amount of significant decisions about how provisional ballots are counted, absentee ballot policies, all these little things that add up to a lot of votes.
There's also a theory that you can do these things to restrict voting, but when people feel like their vote is being restricted, it just makes them all the more serious about casting that vote. Have you heard stories like that in Georgia?
We have. Look, it kind of goes both ways. I mean, in 2018, there was a concern from some people in Stacey Abrams' campaign that the more she talked about voter suppression and restrictions, the more it influenced some voters to say, oh, why bother? You know, if my vote is just going to be, if it's going to be so hard, why bother? But then you're right. There are other voters who said they're even more determined to exercise their right to vote in the face of suppression or restrictions or what they saw as intimidation, whatever it might be, that they were more concerned. I think in 2020, Democrats found that a message that resonated with by saying, have a plan to vote. I think that was really effective. I heard it all over the campaign trail, like, we're going to have a plan to vote. We're not just going to rely on Election Day voting when anything could happen where it could be five-hour waits and people can't stay in line that long. And so instead, you saw a lot of people say, hey, mail-in. And if you can't do mail-in, Dropbox. If you can't do Dropbox, there's a three-week early voting period in Georgia. And if you can't do that, then you can go vote on Election Day. So there's multiple options for voters. And I think that message, we're going to hear Republicans say it too, but for Democrats, it was particularly effective.
Greg Bluestein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Greg Bluestein is a senior political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the author of Flipped: How Georgia Turned Purple and Broke the Monopoly on Republican Power. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.